Okay, well, thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be here. What I'm talking about is mainly contained in three papers, which I've done over the last year and a half. I mean, with Simon Gentle, who is a postdoc at UCLA, and my student, Chrysostomos Marasinou. And I mean, here's a, I'll sort of start with a little overview of what I'm doing, and then review defect operators in field theory of the kind we'll be discussing. Then I'll spend a considerable amount of time on the sort of dual supergravity solutions, I mean, which are I mean, cousins of the bubbling LLM solution. And then sort of the one of the technical parts of the talk is really the calculation of the Ruta-Ganayagi entanglement entropy in those systems. And then I'll try to compare that with basically a kind of replica trick calculation, I mean, of the entanglement entropy due to Lekovitz and Maldacena. When you have defects, I mean, and what I mean, sort of in general, what I'm thinking about is wheels and lines, wheels and surfaces, or surface defects. I mean, well, I'll talk a bit more about the, I mean, why say these are different a little bit later. I mean, when you holographically describe them, I mean, there are different ways of doing this. Yeah, say wheels and line. I mean, originally, Maldacena put a basically a fundamental string in, but then you can also describe many of these objects as probe brains. But once, say, the you have many of those and the back reaction cannot be neglected, then we'll have really a new geometry. And these, I sort of generically, these solutions I call bubbling supergravity solutions. So in supergravity, I mean, and Ruta-Ganayagi told us how to calculate, I mean, in the supergravity approximation, the entanglement entropy. And here we'll do this for basically for the simplest case of spherical entangling surfaces. On the other hand, Lekovitz and Maldacena, I mean, like maybe 2.5 years ago or so, had basically a different in a paper developed a different way of calculating the entanglement entropy in the presence of a defect, and this is basically coming from the fact that you can map the entanglement entropy for a spherical surface into the thermal entropy on a different space. I mean, with a hyperbolic part. And that for the then basically thermodynamics relates this entanglement entropy to the expectation value of the defect and the one-point function of the stress tensor. So what we'll do after the we're basically trying to apply this, but not in field theory, but basically also on the holographic side. And then we would like to compare the basically the Lekovitz-Maldacena and Ruta-Ganayagi result. So the defects which we will focus here on not the wheels and line and the wheels and surfaces, but sort of this order type surface defects in N equals 4 super young mills. And so what are these? I mean, here's maybe a little bit more general stuff about defects. So we'll I mean, how do we distinguish different defects? I mean, the first one is the world volume of the dimension. I mean, say line operators, I mean, like the Wilson line, have one dimension, surface operators have two, there can be domain walls, et cetera. So say when I look at the Wilson loop, it is not a local operator, but it can be written as basically an extended operator, an integral, path-ordered integral, but using the local fields of the theory. I mean, say the gauge fields and the scalars. On the other hand, some defects can not be written that way. They are characterized basically by this by specifying the singular behavior or monodromies of fields near the defect, yeah? and sort of, I mean, that's why I call them this order operator, I mean, from the point of view of the Ising model. Then also, I mean, another characterization of all these defects is the amount of say, superconformal symmetry they preserve. And here we'll basically focus always on defects which preserve basically the maximal amount of possible superconformal symmetry, and we call them half BPS, like, say, the straight or circular Wilson line, I mean, is an example. Now, in, say, for the Wilson line, there's also generically, say, in which representation I consider this, or I mean, for defect operators, also there can be basically a breaking of the gauge symmetry due to the specifying the singular behavior. So the specific cases we look at are the surface defects in n equals 4 super young wheels, which I think were first introduced by Gukov and Witten in this paper. And so one can think about them as two-dimensional surfaces, say, for the time being, just think about them as a two-plane in four Euclidean dimensions, and say the geometry is like this, I mean, with one dimension suppressed. So you have, I mean, two normal directions, and here, say, I'll depict it a radial direction and an angle. It is possible, I mean, to specify these surface defects such that they preserve basically half the full half of the super of the maximal superconformal symmetry of n equals 4 in the vacuum. And then how are these defects characterized in field theory? There's first a breaking of the gauge group to say a product of UN factors. I mean, these are called the Levy group. I mean, this all is sort of, I mean, related to the Langlands program, which I really not talk about at all. But then we have basically the holonomy. Oh, this should be a psi. I mean, the holonomy of the gauge field around the defect, and then for each of these factors. I mean, m. Factors, there is also theta angles basically for the gauge fields on the defect. So we'll have these continuous parameters, alpha and eta. And furthermore, we'll have basically, we'll pick a complex complex combination of the six scalars, say, phi 5 plus I phi 6, and specify the behavior of this complex scalar when it approaches the defect, say, I mean, at r equals 0. And so I'll have additional continuous parameters, beta and gamma. So the data of this defect are all these, I mean, 4m continuous parameters, and then the discrete set of ni, which specifies the breaking. So here, I mean, this setup and this the geometry I had before, yeah, was in R4. There is I mean, but since we preserve, I mean, since n equals 4 is conformal, we can develop an alternative description even in field theory. And that is basically to, I mean, do a while rescaling from R4 to ADS 3 cross S1, or Euclidean ADS 3 cross S1. I mean, there are two things which I mean, this is useful for. One is, I mean, just purely in field theory.
Just remind us what the, since these are singular fields.
Yeah.
These singularities are not singular.
Yeah, I mean, there's even, I mean, this singularity, I mean, that basically the fact that the gauge field is looking this way, I mean, it's basically giving you the breaking of the gauge group. I mean, it's basically a...
well, it's breaking the gauge group, but it's also singular, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So the action is singular at these points.
Yeah.
So what is it, what is the criteria that picks out the boundary dimensions or this regularity, since you're dealing with singular?
Yeah, I mean, actually, in some sense, actually, this map actually makes this a little bit clearer, because basically what happens, I mean, with this map is then basically you have a gauge field, say, then a scalar field, I mean, and then the defect is actually located at the boundary of ADS3, and then it is basically the asymptotic values of that gauge field. So in that sense, I mean, it's basically giving you the boundary conditions as ADS. So in that sense, it's not even, I mean, the singularity comes from the fact that ADS is not 83 is not compact, but it's...
Near the singularity, yeah. Looks like a conformally located.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And that basically would then specify the boundary conditions, say, over which I would have to integrate the fields. And then the holonomy, which we had before, I mean, around the defect is now along S1. So actually, I mean, not short, I mean, a couple of years after the Gukov and Witten paper, like Drucker and Gomez and collaborators, used basically this setup to calculate various field theory observables purely, I mean, semi-classically, I mean, starting with the Super-Young-Mills action, I mean, with these boundary conditions. And I mean, they found actually that, I mean, in this approximation, I mean, semi-classically, the expectation value is 1. You can calculate, I mean, one-point functions, not just of the stress tensor, but that's sort of what we need. And basically, this is basically like an sort of an anomalous scaling dimension, which depends on these parameters beta and gamma.
This is the expectation and the defect operator in SUM.
I mean, it's, yeah, yeah.
What does it mean?
Well, I mean, I guess it's probably due to the fact that this defect preserves, I mean, the maximal amount of supersymmetry. I mean, it's the calculation, if I remember right. I mean, it's not completely trivial because it's, you basically evaluate the Super-Young-Mills action. I mean, on ADS with these boundary conditions.
Normally, if a local operator has an expectation value of ground state, we say it's a condensed model, it's condensed the field.
Right.
So the defects are condensed?
Well, I'm not, I mean, this is.
You have to be careful, there's no mention of this.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is not, I mean, that's not, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So there is also a, this is sort of a semi-classical field theory description. I mean, I'm not talking about like doing quantum corrections around this or so. But I mean, I want to get to holography. I mean, the first description of these defects is using probe brains, and that was actually done. Before. I mean, this whole. I mean, the relation was only pointed out later. But basically, what we actually have is probe brains in D3 brains, and the way to write. I mean, to realize this is that we write basically the ADS. 5, not in sort of standard Poincaré coordinates, but basically in terms of, say, the ADS 5 actually, in terms of an ADS 3 times S1 vibration. And I'm not really using this later, so I'll be pretty quick, that basically these defects can be realized as D3 brains, which fill ADS 3 times S1, and there is basically then, so they're located at some position in this, in this fifth coordinate, U of ADS 5, and these angles, I mean, on ADS, on the S1, and the angle on the, 5 sphere, are related. I mean, I guess I forgot to say that basically this thing is at theta equals pi over 2. And then again, it was pointed out, I mean, by Gomez and collaborators that again there is a map which basically maps, I mean, the field theory parameters beta, gamma, alpha, eta to the probe brain parameters. So, this is a viable description, but it neglects back reaction. I mean, as all probe approximations does. So, if I consider actually very many, that basically these the ni, there are very many of those, and I have to take the back reaction into account. I basically have to replace the I'll have to replace the ADS5 process 5 geometry with a back reactor geometry. And the solution, which actually this corresponds to, was, I mean, is known in the literature, and it's even, I mean, basically it's related to the, I mean, sort of very well-known Lunin-Maldacena solution, and which corresponds to basically the back reaction of a local half BPS operators, I mean, like the strings of phis. And what happens is that, I mean, recall that in the Lunin-Maldacena, we actually had two three spheres, and then basically a four-dimensional space, which was sort of a U1 vibration over a three-dimensional space with boundary. And this vibration, this coordinate was time-like. So what happens in for these solutions, and this is even, I think, in the original paper and then in a follow-up by Lin and Maldacena, I mean, they didn't really do that much with these solutions. But if you actually exchange the, I mean, analytically continue the time-like coordinate to space-like, and then therefore, on the other hand, replace one of the three spheres with an ADS3, I mean, you have still a solution, and it's even still half BPS. What you realize is that this solution is completely determined by this function f, which I'll talk about a little bit more in the next slide, that say this one form in the fiber is related to f. I mean, if given an f, I can solve for v. The only other non-trivial field, I mean, recall that even in the probe description, I mean, we had ADS5 and three brains. I mean, so the only other field which will be sourced, I mean, in the other than the metric, in the fully back-reacted solution is the phi form. And again, I mean, it's a pretty complicated expression, but given in terms basically all of f. So what is f? I should maybe actually, I guess this is bad organization, but I should just actually first go to the picture. We have a three-dimensional base space, and so this is x1, x2, and y. It has a boundary at y equals 0. So the original LLM solution had these two three spheres, and what happens is that basically once I reach the boundary, the space should be geodesically complete, so it has to close off, and this it does this by basically shrinking a three sphere to 0. And but because in the LLM solution I have two three spheres, I have the possibility of shrinking one of them and not the other. And so here that leads to this famous picture of basically coloring a half plane, where like say white and blue is like f equals 1/2 and minus 1/2, where the spheres shrink to 0. And this is basically a boundary condition for this function f. I mean, this f satisfies a differential equation with these boundary conditions. Now, what changes when we make the analytic continuation is that instead of this three sphere, we have an ADS3, which cannot shrink. That would lead to a naked singularity. So we'll really have only one color, namely the one where the three sphere, which is still there, shrinks. But what do we have instead? Instead, we have sources in the bulk of this three-dimensional base space. So there are sources. So this this is the differential equation, which is basically a reduction. I mean, of a six-dimensional Laplace equation. I mean, in the appropriate coordinates, but it's a linear PDE, and then I'll have sources where basically you tell me that I have a source located at some point in x and y in this three-dimensional space. So these I depicted here.
And do those sources correspond to known physical objects, brains of some sort or something?
What happens is that there is a map, again, of the field theory quantities to this data, which I'll actually show. So roughly speaking, For example, I mean, if you compare the probe description to the back reacted description, you would have basically, if you recall that you say for this m, yeah, I mean, you basically have say the splitting of say SUN, and then here we take n basically to be infinity into or very large, I mean, into groups, I mean, m groups of UM. So this would be m stacks of D3 brains at different positions, I mean, in this coordinate. And so indeed, basically, the presence of the source, I mean, can be basically associated, I think, with the source which would be produced by the presence of the probe D3 brains.
So these solutions make sense if m is much, much less than n?
Yes, but I mean well, this is a little bit tricky. I mean, I should actually maybe I'll come. I mean, I'll have the map right. I mean, right away, because what? So let me just. Yeah.
If I could just, I mean, so if the sources in F are supposed to correspond to stacks of D3 brains, and you've included the back reaction.
Yeah.
Then locally near each source, the solution should look like ADS5 cross S5. Is that what happened?
No, because, well, I mean, in some sense, I mean, the only real asymptotic ADS5 cross S5 region is actually, I mean, when I'm going very large. I mean, so I'll have always, I mean, the D3 brains, which, I mean, basically make the ADS5 cross S5.
But you have extra sort of, is the solution actually singular at the
No, this is a completely regular solution. I mean, and this is what happens basically with all, I mean, of these bubbling solutions, that really it's not in a sense that that they reproduce, like, say, the near field behavior of a probe. I mean, it's really replacing the probe by geometry and flux. Yeah.
So just to understand, there's a sense in which there are sources here.
Yeah.
But you say the bulk supergravity equations of motion are satisfied in a source-free way in the interior. When you say the bulk is smooth, is that what you mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so basically, these solutions have sources. But then, I haven't really put this in this. Well, I guess basically what happens is that if you plug in, I mean, the behavior of the fields, I mean, say the metric and the phi form, then it will be a smooth geometry.
No actual source.
Yeah. So basically, if F blows up here, I mean, you see that basically because of this structure, I mean, there will actually be no metric fields will blow up. Okay.
So the location of the source is related before the combination to the location of the other shrinking sphere, or is that?
Well, I mean, I think that's not so. I mean, I'm not sure right now, because it's actually a very different boundary condition. I mean, you have these in a way, the LLM boundary conditions are in a way richer, because you have really the coloring of a two-dimensional R2. Yeah, so here it's continuous parameters, but it's sort of a discrete set of continuous parameters. So I don't know whether, I don't think there is any obvious, it's just that, I mean, that the analytic continuation guarantees, I mean, that I still have local solutions of the equations of motion. I mean, then one has to check that after the analytic continuation, the thing is still supersymmetric. And then I guess that if you have the delta function sources, what you have checked that actually the geometry is smooth, even if I have the delta function sources. Okay, so basically the solution, I mean, of these, I mean, with these sources, I mean, can be, I mean, it's not too hard to find them. Basically it's sort of electrostatic problem. So I'll have these, basically the position in X and Y, how many I have them. I'll come back to what this actually is good for in another slide. Because first, maybe just to show the geometry, is that this solution also has the ADS5 cross S5 vacuum, where basically I have only one source, and I'll have y equals to 1. Now, basically what happens here is that I've basically scaled the ADS radius to 1, ADS 5 radius to 1. Yeah, I mean, so then y is equal to 1. Otherwise, I would say take it to be L. So then, I mean, this is just for the record that basically I can change my these coordinates, the u1 fiber, y, x1, x2. I mean, after a change of variables, I mean, f and v look like this. I'll basically get, indeed, ADS 5 cross S5. In this, basically, I mean, the ADS 5 part is here as an ADS 3 times U1, I mean, coordinate system. So basically, the boundary, I mean, when rho goes, the ADS 5 boundary is in the form ADS 3 times U S1. And so that's why this description of the defect, I mean, in the ADS 3 times S1 coordinates is nice, I mean, for the holographic description. So now what is the, I should have ordered this different. So let's, I mean, since there was a question, I mean, what is the map of the supergravity parameters? I mean, recall that was basically the y and the axis to the parameters of the gauge theory description of the defect. And so what you realize is basically that the position of the in the x plane, yeah, is related to this beta plus I gamma, and the location in y is related basically to the ratio of ni over n. And so, I mean, what happens, I mean, because we're in the supergravity description, is that this discrete variable actually becomes a continuous variable. I mean, that basically the y's, and if I said L equals 1, basically the larger the y is, the more, the more part of the n is in the ith gauge group, and then there is a constraint, I mean, for regularity, that basically the sum over the y squared is basically 1, so which tells us that the sum over the n i's is n.
In the case of
Arjuna,
you just have one y that also makes sense for you?
Yeah, well, that's because I scale basically l equals to 1. I mean, so basically n, I mean, I mean, since I'm just doing the supergravity approximation here, I mean, basically the n dependence is all up front.
In the case that m is 1.
Oh, yeah, m is 1, yeah. But that is only the ADS 5 cross S5 vacuum. So basically, that was this solution. I mean, basically, since I have actually the translation to 0 and then a scale solution. Okay, so. Just for the calculation of the entanglement entropy, I'll basically have to I have to talk a little bit about the behavior near the ADS 5 boundary for the general solution. And so then it's obviously not, I mean, the full bubbling solution is not just ADS 5 cross S5. So I can make a change of coordinates to a sort of Pfefferman-Graham form. Where basically u goes to 0 corresponds to approaching the asymptotic ADS boundary. In the, I mean, I don't really give, I mean, the formulas are very bulky, but basically, I mean, in this geometry, what in x and y, what this really corresponds to is going very far out, I mean, both in x and y. So then, I mean, there are basically these are all possible terms, and some, I mean, will actually only, will decay with u. I mean, these terms are all zero, I mean, when u goes to zero. But the important thing is that here what I'm doing is that I'm doing this Pfefferman-Graham expansion, not basically with a, say, here, a Poincaré, I mean, or R4 boundary, but an ADS3 times S1 boundary. And then I define my Pfefferman-Graham cutoff basically by setting u equals to epsilon, and I can invert this basically, which gives me a relation of this radial coordinate, which is basically roughly speaking the sum of the x squared plus x1 squared plus x2 squared plus y squared, to the cutoff in the other coordinates. Now, these things are like horrible expressions. I mean, the details are in the paper, but the main thing is that this is basically like a multipole expansion in some sense, I mean, for large radius. So what appears, basically, are these multiple powers of my parameters, and basically summed over all m. And this is basically, where does it come from? That comes from the fact that this f is basically a sum over over these different fi's, I mean, where this is basically the expression for the ith source, and then I basically look at this at large x squared plus y squared. So, okay. So there is a little bit, there's a little bit more to that. I mean, I have the beta and gamma. I mean, there's also the alpha and epsilon. And I mean, recall that these were the monodromy and the theta angles. And they are actually realized that, I mean, in some sense here from this source, you can sort of say that, I mean, that there is a two cycle where there can be some topological flux. I mean, I don't have the field strengths of the two form anti-symmetric tensor fields are zero in this solution, but there can basically be additional topological data for basically everything I do. This doesn't really play a role, but I mean, this identification was all basically proposed by Gomez and Matsuura. Okay. So now I wanted to talk about the holographic entanglement entropy. And so let's go back to basically the simple setup where we have where we're in R4 and the defect is basically a two plane. So here I've neglected one dimension, and basically this is then I'll have a spherical a ball as entangling space and the entangling surface. I mean, the boundary is a sphere. Here, I mean, with one dimension neglected, basically the defect is a one-dimensional line. And you see that in this case, for this surface defect, the defect intersects the entangling surface. Whereas with the same setup, if I had a Wilson line, I mean, because basically what say I can think of that I neglect time, basically the Wilson line, and that's sort of the setup of Lekowitz-Maldacena, would just sit in the center here and would not intersect the boundary of A. So this is basically what I would call the spherical coordinate system. And I mean, this is basically said here that the defect basically, I mean, is extended in time and this is a radial coordinate now, and it's basically say in the direction where it intersects these two antipodal points, whereas the boundary of A is just the sphere. Now, as I said, I mean, in the field theory and for us also in the holography, we are actually looking at where the four-dimensional space where the field theory lives is, while mapped to ADS3 cross S1. So if you perform this map, becomes this, but then also the geometry of the defect and the entangling surface changes. And so here we actually, I mean, as I said, I mean, and you can chase that through. I mean, once you write down the maps, I mean, it fills time. It goes along the direction, along the boundary, but it is basically at the boundary, z equals 0. That's where the defect is. And the entangling surface here, and that's maybe not totally obvious, but it's basically in terms of the L and the Z, it's sort of like a semicircle, along here. So I'll perform the...
Physically, in terms of what it is you're discussing,
yeah.
Discussing the entanglement of an observer inside a ball.
Yeah.
Who doesn't ignores what's outside, except for this defect.
Yeah, but and the defect.
Conditions on the defect and the field of the defect all the way out to infinity.
Right. But true that say even if I actually do this, I mean then at the end I like the Cassini-Werder-Myers map or so. I mean that's because the defect is inside A. I mean, it doesn't disappear. I mean, it's still there. Yeah, so it has a physical effect. Yeah. So I'll calculate a holographic entanglement entropy using the Ruta-Kanayagi prescription. So I have to find a minimal surface in the bulk, I mean, in this complicated geometry, which extends basically on the boundary and ends on the entangling surface, I mean, delta A. And then I'll take this area, basically, and that's that's entanglement entropy. So, I mean, we have not just the ADS here. I mean, we also have these other spaces. So basically, one question is, I mean, what do I choose as my minimal surface? And I mean, it's at fixed time. I mean, we are unlike in LLM. I mean, this is really a static space time. I mean, so we can simply work at a fixed time slice. And what we choose is that our minimal surface extends over over the three sphere, extends over the three dimensional space and the U1 fiber. So it's basically as large as, I mean, and this is basically, I mean, otherwise, if I choose a different parameterization, that would break, I mean, all the O4, I mean, the symmetries associated with rotations of the sphere and shifts along the fiber. So basically, what this means is that, I mean, this is kind of trivial. I mean, I just drop it. But that in general, the minimal surface really has a profile, I mean, in this ADS3, and basically where the ADS3, like radial or Poincaré coordinate set, depends on L, and then basically all the four other coordinates of the fiber and the three-dimensional space. So if one basically uses the bubbling solution, one can derive the induced metric and calculate the area functional. And basically, with this ansatz, I mean, that's what you get. Now, that looks like a big mess. I mean, very complicated. But it's actually, in a way, even already a little bit less complicated what you might have feared, I mean, from the complications of the ansatz. But you also see that in all the, I mean, all these terms are basically perfect squares, and with the boundary condition here, that actually this will also always be positive. So certainly one solution, and then I think it basically can be argued because these add to the any non-zero behavior here would actually add, is basically given by ignoring all the behavior on the base and the fiber and simply having this, what you would actually have just for the pure ADS5 cross S5 vacuum, namely this kind of semicircle, I mean, in this ADS coordinate. And then the minimal area is basically calculation splits into two. One is basically the integral over this coordinate in the ADS3, and one is an integral over basically the base, and the fiber, I mean, just produces a factor of 2 pi. So, split, and now, I mean, both of these integrals are actually divergent. Namely, I mean, recall that when I take basically the large rho, I mean, which means the large radius here, yeah, that's the basically our Pfefferman-Graham cutoff. But even this integral, I mean, is divergent because of the infinite volume of ADS3. So what I'll do here, I mean, it's a little bit non-standard, is that I introduce two cutoffs. Basically, this is a cutoff which is basically the UV cutoff, yeah, in the field theory, where the boundary is ADS3 cross S1. And then, but because I have basically a non-compact ADS3, I also regularize the infinite volume of ADS3. So, but these two integrals don't talk to each other, so basically I can regularize them independently. So this one gives produces a logarithmic divergence. Now the technical difficulty is in evaluating this other integral. I mean, because this f, this function f, I mean, was pretty complicated. So the first thing what one can do is one can do this, again, for the ADS5 crosses 5 vacuum. I mean, this would be no defect. Actually, that change of variables, I mean, which I indicated before, I mean, from the y, x, the x1, x2 to like the theta and rho, then, I mean, basically makes this trivial to do. So, I mean, we'll get sort of familiar, I mean, divergent contributions, I mean, with the UV cutoff. Yeah? And so this is basically then, this would be the, I mean, with these, in terms of these two cutoffs, the result for the entanglement entropy just of a spherical entangling surface, I mean, maybe calculated in the world's most complicated way. But for this, I mean, for the, I mean, the point is the ADS3 crosses 3 boundary. I mean, it's not the usual R4. So when one does this calculation for the general one, I mean, what one realizes, this is actually still not too bad. It might even seem that this is very easy. And namely because what, and this is in some sense a miracle when you look at, I mean, how complicated the metric is, that at this integral at the end is really just linear in F. So, and these Fs are basically contributions from each of the sources separately, I mean, just summed over. So I can basically evaluate this integral for each of the contributions of the sources separately. And then when you look at this and you say you integrate over this whole base, it seems like that what that this shouldn't actually, I mean, at first sight, the result should not depend on the location of x and y. And because you can shift because we integrate over all x, you can shift the position xi away, and you can, I mean, that takes a little bit more work, you can basically scale the yi to 1 by an appropriate rescaling of the x and the y. So basically, does that mean that you basically get just the m times the result of the vacuum? And the answer is no, because we have to regularize, and we have to impose the Pfefferman-Graham cutoff for the UV regularization of the ADS5 boundary. And this cutoff is not invariant under this. I mean, it's sort of like in the Feynman diagrams there, yeah, when you have divergences. I mean, some change of variables are legit for convergent diagrams, and convergent integrals are not legit for divergent ones. And so basically, but it actually is. And I'm not going into the technical details. I mean, it's still quite a bit of work. But basically, the idea of shifting this is actually a good one because it makes the integral very simple. I mean, just evaluating the integral with the xi and the yi is, I mean, we couldn't do it. But when you make this shift, where you basically shuffle the this dependence is in the Pfefferman-Graham cutoff function, rho c, and so then we can do the integrals, and the only thing we have to do is we'll basically have to then take into account basically the shift of the Pfefferman-Graham surface. Now, to leading order, that obviously it cannot make a difference, but it makes a difference basically for a finite contribution. And sort of to make a long story short is that that one can evaluate the root Takanayagi entropy here, and you see that basically we'll get, basically the same term as in the vacuum, and these moments. I mean, remember that this is what this is like basically the sum of yi squared plus x one squared, and this is yi squared x two I squared, and this is yi to the fourth. Yeah? So it's only these moments which appear. So it's a very nice simple formula, and then here, what I mean to actually renormalize, get basically what we'll do is, I mean, and this is maybe I'm a poor man's renormalization, is we subtract the vacuum result, and then we'll basically, what this means is that these epsilon divergences disappear, but I mean, since everything is multiplied by this other integral over the ADS quantities, we still have this logarithmic divergence. So this would be basically our result for the root Takanayagi calculation. And one can basically, re-express this in terms of field theory quantities, for example, yeah, which I haven't done here. So one curious thing, I mean, I'm not 100% sure, I mean, exactly what to make of it is that there's sort of maybe a two-dimensional CFT interpretation of this entanglement entropy. And that's basically because, I mean, if I think about this bubbling geometry simply as, say, a seven-dimensional space, complicated metric, and an alias 3 factor, I could ask, basically, where if I actually try to consider the Brown-Hanoi central charge, just think about this. I mean, if this is compact, I mean, this is probably very legitimate, of this ADS3 factor. And then I have to take into account, I mean, basically, that I have to relate the 10-dimensional, the three-dimensional Newton's constant to the 10-dimensional Newton's constant. And then, but what basically, if I, and the fact that this is non-compact, so what I will look at is, again, basically the difference of the, of this Brown-Hanoi central charge for this ADS3, basically comparing the vacuum to my bubbling solution. And it's, I mean, it might be obvious, but it wasn't really obvious to us. But what happens actually is that this is exactly related to that integral we've been calculating before. And so that basically that if I basically calculate this sort of what we call effective Brown-Hanoi central charge, that this is directly related up to this cutoff term to the entanglement entropy. And if you re-express this in terms of field theory quantities, I mean, it's interesting to see, because this is a little bit reminiscent of a formula which I think was derived by Gade and Gukov. I mean, for sort of defects which are pure holonomy defects. This is not really legitimate, but if you forget about this, then actually like a Kähler sigma model, and the dimension of that is actually given by this. So there might be something, I mean, once I turn on the not just holonomies but also singular behavior, that maybe there is a way of actually interpreting this really sort of from the field theory side. That would be very nice.
So that sounds like a background charge, right, the second term?
Yeah.
So the only way you can have that term, because it's continuous, if the C is to be changing continuously, you have like a background charge of the Newbie theory?
Well, maybe. I mean, I don't know. It would be very...
Their signal was non-compact? Could you induce background charge for their sigma model?
Well, that would be very interesting, yeah. I mean, it might... I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, we haven't really thought much about it. I mean, but I can, maybe we can. Okay, so now, I mean, the last.
That is negative correction.
Well, I mean, I guess the sum of the, I mean, this is, this would actually be, I mean, this would always be strictly positive. Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess there's, I think if you chase it, I mean if you actually look at this, I mean this is basically the, I mean, because there are these restrictions on, I mean, the y, I mean this, I think this can be in general be positive or negative, but then again, I guess maybe with some Lewis will, I mean, then doesn't necessarily have to be unitarity.
Q squared could be positive or negative, yeah. So it depends on what
structure. Okay, so in the last part of the talk, I basically wanted to now compare this our result to a different way of calculating entanglement entropy. And I mean, I should say that at the end we're finding some mismatch, which we're not really sure about and still thinking about. So, but I think it's maybe an interesting question. So I think it's worth just doing that and presenting that. So. So, I mean, Cassini, Werder, Myers maybe were the first to relate that, I mean, like an entanglement entropy for, I mean, a spherical entangling surface can be mapped, I mean, to maybe an easier problem, which is a thermal entropy on basically hyperbolic space times a thermal circle. I mean, by a wider scaling. And so, I mean, in like 2 years ago, Vasily Lekovits and Maldacena basically used this to calculate the entanglement entropy in the presence of a Wilson line. And basically that, I mean, you sort of the standard thermodynamic definition, I mean, of the of this entropy. And what you need, the data which you need, is basically the expectation value of the defect, and then the one-point function of the stress tensor in the presence of the defect. Now, in the case for a half BPS Wilson loop, yeah, all these quantities, I mean, for in a semi-classical, these quantities, I mean, in n equals 4 super Young Mills for the half BPS Wilson loop can all be calculated in terms of, matrix model integrals via localization. And so, I mean, these are actually known basically for arbitrary representations, no matter how big they are. I mean, the matrix model is complicated. I mean, known meaning they're known as matrix model integrals. I mean, whether you can actually do the integral, I mean, analytically, that's not really possible. I mean, for very complicated representations, but there is an expression in terms of basically a matrix model integral. So basically, what we did, I mean, in this, Simon and I in this first paper, was that we basically there are bubbling solutions just like the one we had before, which actually like. Eric Doker, John Estes, and I found, several years ago, which are dual basically to the fully back-reacted geometry of the Wilson line. I don't explain it here, but basically this whole, machinery basically can also be used, basically calculate the Ru Takanayagi entropy, entanglement entropy for these bubbling solutions. We did this, and then also calculate the expectation value and the stress tensor, basically, from the bubbling solution, and then basically plug them into. To say this is the Ru Takanayagi, and then use the LM plug the two results in. And what we basically found was that this can be expressed in terms of a matrix integral. Now, these bubbling solutions actually also have an exact identification, just like the identification of the parameters, of the defects, of the parameters of the supergravity solution with the appropriate matrix model. It's even like that basically, say there is a harmonic function, basically that is related to the resolvent of the corresponding matrix model. That was actually pointed out by, also by Gomez in a different paper. But if you use this identification, then basically both sides can be expressed basically in terms of integrals, and in the large lambda large n limit, I mean, where supergravity is valid, I mean, the matrix model becomes, can be evaluated using saddle point methods, and then the two agree. So basically, we'll have an agreement between the Ru Takanayagi and this Lekovits-Maldacena. Now, I guess that probably won't come shocking to you, but I think this is sort of an indication that this whole story holds together, and that this identification of the bubbling solutions is right, and so on. So now we wanted to basically see whether we can do the same, because we have basically all the same ingredients for our surface defects. Now.
So you gave the formula for Wilson lines.
Yeah.
What would be the formula for defects?
Well, so here, I guess basically, the most naive thing what we did, and actually since it doesn't match up, maybe this is not really right, we're using, the same thing.
Same formula.
Yeah, same formula. But the geometry is, one has to basically see that before we had these two geometries. I mean, this was basically the R4 geometry, I mean, where the defect is basically localized in a two-plane. Here, we have the ADS3, so there is a third one, I mean, which is basically the Cassini-Huerta-Meyers map, I mean, which usually goes from here to here, to the S1 times H3. So what we'll basically have is, I mean, you can connect these maps, I mean, we'll map basically from here to here. So, so what happens is that, I mean, so we have basically an S1 and a radial coordinate and S2 here. So this is the three-dimensional hyperbolid. So what happens is that in some sense here, the location of the defect actually changes. Yeah, here it's basically at the boundary of ADS. Now for the hyperboloid, what happens is that it is along the Euclidean, this S1. That would basically be exactly the situation as Legowitz and Maldacena had for their Wilson loop. But since we have a two-dimensional surface, the surface, I mean, extends in another dimension, and it turns out, I mean, when you do this map, yeah, that it basically is along this radial coordinate. So it's along the radial coordinate of the hyperboloid, or if you map it to, say, sort of a Poincaré disk, yeah, it would be the radial coordinate there. So it is extended, but, I mean, hope springs eternal, yeah? So we'll basically what is possible is to basically use holography to calculate the expectation value and the one-point function of the stress tensor. The one-point function of the stress tensor actually was calculated using these bubbling solutions, I mean, by Drucker and Gomez. It basically depends on this kind of anomalous scaling dimension. I mean, that was very similar to the Wilson line. Yeah, and actually, I mean, what you see is that basically, I mean, it sort of seems maybe that's a little bit encouraging because these are exactly the moments which kind of appeared before, I mean, which is probably not so deep because, I mean, there's dimensional analysis behind it. But nevertheless, I mean, they don't exactly appear in the same way. So this stress, one-point function of the stress tensor wouldn't be enough. So we would have to calculate the expectation value of the defect and semi-classically. We have a problem because, I mean, we have, this basically the only non-trivial fields here is the metric and the phi form, and no three form of scalars are turned on. So basically, I mean, it seems that the self-dual, I mean, the absence of an action, yeah, for a self-dual field is somewhat of an inconvenience, and it is. And again, this might actually also not be right. I mean, I'm not that comfortable, but basically there was actually in an old paper, I mean, by Steve and Joe, a prescription where I'll basically take, I mean, and this is really very easy to do for our solution, basically take the phi form, I mean, there's an electric and magnetic component, I mean, a component which has time, and then take basically four times the electric part, instead of the electric minus the magnetic, which would be zero. Yeah? So one can do this. The better way maybe is to use, I mean, these other proposals for self-dual actions, but they are very complicated. And then one would have to redo basically all the analysis of the solution and the supersymmetry in this formulation. So what we did was use this way of getting something non-zero. Basically, again, it's a reasonably complicated calculation, I mean, quite technical. We have to use this bulk part. There's also a Gibbons-Hawking part. And so what comes out is the following. So there is basically, again, this moment, and then there is some additional term, which is sort of a mess. Yeah, I mean, it contains the moments too, but it contains actually products of moments, different moments, and so it's much more complicated. But the outcome here is that if I basically use this LM formula, and plug everything, I mean, map it from ADS3 to S1 to S1 times H3. Treat this basically as, I mean, the holographically calculated quantities, I mean, now as basically field theory data, do the mapping and plug the results in, I'll get the following. So indeed, this, I mean, that one term, which is not so bad, yeah, that that nicely combines. This is actually really delta SA, but I'll have this extra term. Now, if I look at how this extra term looks like in field theory, it's, I mean, it has actually the moment seem quite a big mess. In field theory language, it's much less of a mess, but it's still, I mean, much more, I mean, you don't just, I mean, it's a square, yeah, it's, and it's, it basically has fourth order terms here. So you might argue that it is actually suppressed, I mean, in large N. Yeah, but I mean, where this comes from or what this means, we're really not sure. The conclusion.
Even in large N, you have that one half
term. Yeah. You would probably have to make these two things to. About these things, yeah, I'm not sure whether I would be. I mean, to be honest, we are not really, I mean, we have no idea where this comes from. One thing, the data, which, or the kind of thing, the interpretation, which we have about this mismatch, is that first, I mean, for a one-dimensional defect, everything worked like a charm. Yeah, I mean, we had for the Wilson loop, it worked perfectly. Now, actually, in a different paper, we did this, all these steps I presented here for these n equals 4 surface defects for bubbling solutions in M theory, which basically are the sort of back reacted solutions of Wilson surfaces for the 6-dimensional 0-2 theory. And there, actually, we also didn't, I mean, basically do, I mean, with the same level of kind of, unsophistication, I mean, meaning that the way we did our calculations, regarding regularization and everything, but we also found a mismatch. So basically, I mean, right now we're still a bit, it's not clear to us, I mean, where this comes from, I mean, whether this, this could be that this is really just an artifact of our cutoffs. I mean, you remember that we had two cutoffs, that in reality, I mean, there should really be only one UV cutoff. I mean, physically it's clear, I mean, when you chase these maps through that, I mean, these two cutoffs have certainly an interpretation. I mean, that basically this eta cutoff, which, I mean, these things depended on at the end, really has to do with basically cutting off the space near the defect. Yeah, so it's, I mean, from the ADS3 perspective, it's sort of like a IR cutoff, I mean, which cuts off the infinite volume of the ADS, but when you look at the geometry, it really basically cuts off, in some sense, maybe the intersection, I mean, basically the divergence is coming from the intersection of the surface and the entangling surface. But, I mean, it's still, basically, when you think about if you have a map to a proper Poincaré coordinate, I mean, Feynman-Graham cutoff, there should be one UV cutoff. So maybe a more careful treatment of the cutoffs actually makes this go away, and we find agreement. Now, again, the prescription we used for the on-shell supergravity action maybe is also debatable. But there could also be a light, that just means that we've done the wrong calculation. But there might be something more profound going on. I mean, one thing is, I mean, one difference between the Wilson loop and the surface defects is that here the surfaces, I mean, are two-dimensional, and so there, I mean, whereas for a one-dimensional defect, there is no anomaly, but because this is even dimensional, there could be sort of Graham-Witten type anomalies associated with basically that map, I mean, from ADS3 times S1 to H3 times S1. There's also something that, I mean, that we don't, that even in LM, I mean, basically, the derivation is basically like a thermodynamic identity. So you take a derivative with respect to the periodicity or the inverse temperature, so that actually that could actually act, I mean, on the defect operator. Now, I have really no idea how to really calculate that, but there could be an additional contribution there. So it could be either the wrong calculation or maybe, another contribution which actually makes this work. Or, the other thing is that this LM, the LM prescription really shouldn't be applied for objects which are extended in another direction than the thermal circle. And what we're sort of thinking about now is, maybe do what we should have done first, because it's maybe easier, basically do this calculation in the probe approximation. Both the one-point functions can be calculated, and, there are several prescription, to basically calculate the contribution of the defect due to the probe brain. Recently, like Ullmann and Karsh had a paper, and see whether there is actually a mismatch there too. Yeah, and so that's maybe that's the thing we're thinking about right now. So I'm sorry, I went over time. Okay.
Well, you were comparing the ADS3 process 1 version to this S1 cross the 3-dimensional hyperboloid, but it looked like your calculation for all Euclidean. So those geometries are really the same. And
yeah.
It looked like the only difference was the surface that you chose to put your defect on.
Right, right.
In case it went right through the center.
Yeah.
In case it was one sort of
right.
planar.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's true. That's true. But I think, physically, the bubbling geometry, really nails us down, to one interpretation, which was my ADS3 cross S1. What is the geometry of the entangling surface and what is the defect? So I think actually when you map these, then that because the actual expectation values change. Unfortunately, I don't think I have the. The ADS3 and the Psi1, but then the time component of which I actually take that's the component which I need for the LM formula. Basically, it kind of sits in here, so that the numbers change. That was sort of naively actually we said let's just take this and call this tau, and then but that doesn't really work. Yeah. Well, our thing doesn't work either.
The effective central charge that you identified. Well, I guess no. This page was fine. I was going to ask, can you find it somewhere else, like in the, for example, if you pretend that maybe it is a 2D CFT living on this thing. Could you find it in, say, the change of the stress energy tensor expectation?
Oh,
volume?
Yeah. That I don't know. The only thing I know. We had a email conversation with Bruno Le Floch, or so I guess it was Gomez's student. That basically this term. Gade and Gukov paper, they are basically this is actually the dimension. Of their sigma model, which I would then interpret as the central charge. Different kind of defects.
Yeah, I was asking in your calculation. Forget about that. In your calculation, could you also see a pop up?
Well, that's probably yes. There's sort of a bit. If this were compact, then I just integrate everything. There are these epsilon divergences, which are basically. The only way I deal with them is again by vacuum subtraction. But if I basically take the log piece, then I bet. Because this is basically the Brown-Hanau formula. So it should probably be calculable, say, with a two-point function or so of a stress tensor in the geometry. But I mean, since I have to do this regularization and vacuum subtraction, I mean, it might not be so easy to see.
Yeah. So I think that now that I look at your formula more carefully, that is the dimension of the Grassmannian times two, which I think actually is the cotangent of Grassmannian.
Oh, okay.
And the non-compact direction is the cotangent direction. So if you take the linear charge in the cotangent direction, that could be the tangent charge.
I see. That will be, I mean, very interesting. Okay. Yeah.
In the case of the Wilson line, you said you had agreement for large n and large lambda.
Well,
so
that
how,
was
how good is
well,
that?
Basically, the point is what I need to do. I mean, at the end when I mean, so basically, what happens is, so let's say I calculate, I mean, basically at the end, I end up with, say, the Ruta-Kanayagi formula, and I can write it in terms, basically, actually of an integral, which basically looks like something, I mean, which would be basically a matrix model integral. And then these things, with the localization formulas, I also can write them in terms of something which looks like a matrix model integral. And the identification of the supergravity solution and the basically the Wilson loop or the matrix model is really quite direct. I mean, in the sense that like the harmonic function, I mean, basically can be directly related to the resolvent of the matrix model. So both of these basically look can be basically you can sort of rewrite the Ruta-Kanayagi formula basically as an integral which involves the matrix model and basically matrix model resolvent. Now they don't look exactly the same, but when you have the saddle, I mean when you do large n large lambda with the saddle point, then you can actually, and that's what we did, we showed that they are the same, that they agree. But that is basically the regime where, I mean, you trust the supergravity anyway. So, I mean, it's, Yes?
How easy would it be to repeat this sort of analysis for a defect operator that wraps the entangling surface, so you can choose a spherical entangling region in the boundary?
I mean, so it's basically like coincides?
Yeah.
Certainly, I don't think there's any, the holographic solutions, I mean, they describe, say, the defect operator. So I would have to choose, I mean, in principle, I can choose any entangling surface I like, I mean, for Ruta-Kanayagi.
Right.
The problem is, I mean, that basically this I mean, the spherical surface, I mean, was basically really, I mean, this whole thing was only solvable because I mean, even this in general would be like, I mean, completely impossible to solve the equations. So I would imagine that for, I mean, but this is a very, so I don't know, it might be because it's still a very symmetric solution.
Right.
I mean, that's probably, I mean, that might be worth looking at, but I think it would basically mean, I mean, here, from the perspective of the holography, I think it would just mean, let's look at maybe other ansatz, I mean, for the entangling surface, which one could actually maybe calculate this. Then at least on the holographic side, I think one could do it. Yeah. But for LM, I'm also not sure.
Any other questions? Thank Michael again.